You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the U.S. Census released new data that shows household incomes in the country are rising. We'll talk about what that means for Wisconsin and for the economy. First, depending on when you were born, you may remember watching movies like Matilda or Mrs. Doubtfire with your kids, or you may remember watching it as a kid yourself. Well, Mara Wilson was the little girl with starring roles in both of those movies.
Where'd all this come from?
A library.
The library? You've never set foot in a library. You're only 4 years old.
Six and a half.
You're four.
Six and a half.
If you were six and a half, you'd be in school already.
I want to be in school. I told you I was supposed to start school in September. You wouldn't listen.
Get up. Get up. Get out here. Give me that book. Here is pie. How old is Matilda?
Four. I'm six and a half, Mommy.
Five, then.
It was six in August.
You're a liar.
I want to go to school.
School? It's out of the question. Who would be here to sign for the packages? We can't leave valuable packages sitting out on the doorstep. Now go watch TV like a good kid.
Now an adult, the former child actress wrote a memoir about going from fame to what she calls relative but happy obscurity. Her book, Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame, is out now and looks back at the unique experience of being a child star and also details the more common one of just being a kid and coming of age. Mara Wilson joins us now to tell us about her new book. Mara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when you look back on your childhood, how out of the ordinary do you think it was compared to other kids?
I think that it was very unusual, but I think it took me a long time to realize just how unusual it was. My parents tried very hard to keep me grounded and to keep me living the same, you know, lower middle class existence that I lived for the rest of my life. You know, I had a shared room with my little sister. I still went to public school for most of my life. I went to Girl Scouts. I did things like that. And it was very important to them that I keep it that way. And so I think it really took me a while to realize that, you know, I knew that people were recognizing me all the time. But also, I went to school with a bunch of child actors. And they were all, you know, there were people on Seventh Heaven. There were people doing commercials. A lot of my best friends were child actors. My first boyfriend was a child actor. So it was kind of part of the culture of L.A. where I grew up in the Valley. It was just kind of something that we did the same way that, you know, kids in Texas play, I don't know, play football or something like that. You know, kids in Canada play hockey. It was just part of the thing that we did. So I think it wasn't until I got much older that I realized that I had an impact and a positive impact at that.
And one thing that did seem pretty out of the ordinary was the way you're very open about your fears and your anxieties and your neuroses. And you spend a chunk of time, especially in the beginning, talking about how when you were a kid, well, actually, probably till you were in your preteens, early teens, you were preoccupied with death, which seems really at odds with this optimistic, spunky little girl that we know you for from your early roles. What was that like?
Yeah, I was a pretty dark kid. I mean, I was very extroverted, and I was very, you know, and my family says that I was a very, you know, sweet and well-behaved kid, but I was just obsessed with death, and I had all these really dark moments, even though, you know, I was living a pretty happy life. So I don't know where that comes from. I just think that that's, you know, kind of who I was. Eventually, you know, my mother got sick and died, and that was very hard for me, and that definitely exacerbated things. But I think that it was just kind of the way that I was. I think that a lot of children are very dark. A lot of children go through a dark phase, and, you know, it's whether, depending on their life, you know, if they live a good, happy life, or if they have something, you know, sad happen to them, that can definitely affect their outlook.
It sounds like your mom was a really grounding force while you were being a child actor. And you tell this great story in the book about how you learned pretty young what sex was, and you could not contain it. You had this knowledge bomb, and it was going to go off, and it did. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. When I was a kid, I would lay awake at night. Yeah, when I was a kid, I would lie awake at night thinking, did anybody remember that? Does anybody remember that? So my mother taught me about sex a little bit by showing me like a special, I think, on PBS or something, and then explaining to me, you know, what these kids were doing. And so then I went the next day to the set, and I knew that there was like, it was this big secret, but I started asking people, like I asked one of the hair and makeup women if she knew about sex and if she'd done it. And it was, I just started singing, I know about sex, I know about sex. And I looked over at my mother, and my mother was furious with me, just so mad at me. But fortunately, Robin Williams and Chris Columbus came over, and they were just laughing about it because, you know, they knew that I was a kid, and they knew that kids made these kinds of mistakes. So it was just, it was, you know, just kind of acceptable for them. And I think because of them, I avoided getting in major trouble.
I want to talk about what it was like being thinking about how you looked when you were that age, because at a certain point you talk about you go to Japan and you discover people there think you're really cute and that makes you feel good. But later on, that emphasis on looks sort of turns on you. You're not cute enough for Hollywood anymore. So how did that impact the way you saw yourself and your self-esteem?
It definitely affected me. I mean, when I was very young, I think it was just sort of like, I didn't really like being told I was cute all the time because it felt a little bit like, you know, when your mom's friends get together and they say, oh, I remember when you were this big, you know, it makes you feel that big or that small again, you know, it makes you feel childish. And so I didn't like that. But then when I went through puberty, I lost a superpower I didn't even know I had. You know, I thought that And it definitely stuck with me for a very long time because I knew that I wasn't attractive enough for Hollywood. So I think there was a part of me that thought that I just wasn't attractive, period. There was nothing attractive about me at all, that I was hideous. But I think that, you know, I've come to accept that, you know, I have my assets and flaws like everybody else. And, you know, just because you're not attractive enough for Hollywood doesn't mean that there's, like, anything wrong with you. And it really made me realize how much emphasis we put on looks and how ridiculous it is that we put emphasis on looks in everyday life.
I'm thinking about child actors, the actors who played Punky Brewster or Macaulay Culkin or Anthony Michael Hall. And it seems like in some cases, it can be hard to emerge as an intact adult after you've been a big child star. Do you know how you did it?
I think that really what helped me was that I had other interests. I had other things I wanted to do. I had other pursuits, you know. I studied improv comedy, and I was in choir, and I did drama. So stage acting and performing was something that I really loved, too. And I also always knew that I loved writing. I wanted to be a writer from when I was really little. And so writing was something that definitely kept me going. I think that I had a family that loved me and supported me no matter what. And, you know, I always felt like I had their support and their care and their love. I mean, therapy also didn't hurt. I think that, you know, it was a combination of things. But I think that also my parents never pushed me into acting. So when I said, and they weren't living off my money, so when I said that I didn't want to act anymore, or, you know, actually it was my father who said, you know, maybe take some time off right now, I was okay with it. And they were okay with it as well.
We're talking with Mara Wilson right now, writer, playwright, actor, and storyteller, and probably best known for her roles in Mrs. Doubtfire, Matilda, Miracle on 34th Street. Her new book is called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. And you write in several places in your book about Robin Williams. And, of course, he was on set with you in Mrs. Doubtfire. You knew him when you were pretty young, and then a little bit later on in What Dreams May Come. What was he like to you? What was your relationship?
Oh, he was just the kindest, gentlest guy. He was so fatherly. And, you know, he has a lot of, you know, inappropriate material when he does stand-up. But with kids, he is never inappropriate at all. He's always telling jokes that he knew we thought would be funny. He listened to us, and that was really nice. He talked to us like we were people. He respected us like we were people. And so he was a lot of fun, although my mother always said that he was very quiet when he was talking with adults. She pointed out that he was very quiet with adults, but he definitely came alive when he was with kids and definitely came alive when he had an audience.
I noticed you started out talking about him in the present tense, and then you switched to past tense. Is he someone who still seems present in your life?
Well, I just think that he was such, I never imagined that we would lose him. He does seem like he is just such this large presence and somebody. I think when you affect somebody at a young age in a positive way, you're going to stick with them for the rest of their life. And I think that that's definitely what it was for me. He was, he was kind of like a favorite teacher. And so to me, there is this thing that lives on, there is this part of him that definitely lives on.
And he was an actor, a comedian, and storyteller. He created these stories on the spot. And I notice, you're doing storytelling now, too. This is something you've really always wanted to do.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you make that bridge from child actor to storyteller?
Well, I always wanted to tell stories. That was what I hoped that, people could do, because I just loved standing up and performing stories that I made up and, stories about my life from when I was a kid. And I did well whenever I had to write about my own life. And I did well in that. I did well with that in college. And so I started focusing on that in college. I took an autobiography writing class, and it was something that people were suddenly interested in hearing about, especially considering since I'd had an interesting life. So I think my sophomore year of college, I did a piece about my relationship with my father, and it really seemed to resonate with so many people, which was surprising to me because I thought the details were very specific to my relationship, but it turns out the more personal you get with storytelling, the more universal it is. So I started focusing on that, and then my senior year, I did a show called Weren't You That Girl? That was all about my child acting, and that went over extremely well. And I started looking into it, and what I learned was that there was this big storytelling scene in New York City. I mean, you've heard of The Moth, but there was also shows like Risk and Bear and all kinds of things where people were just telling stories on stage. And the stories, had to be fully formed. They couldn't just be anecdotes. They had to be interesting. And they were. And I started going to these shows, and I started performing at them, and I kind of learned by doing, although there are definitely storytelling classes you can take. And so I learned by doing, and that is really how I started getting some of the stories for this book as well.
Mara, you're very upfront about your anxiety, like we were talking about earlier. And as we wrap up, what advice do you have for someone who wants to uncover, as you would say, their inner badass and get out there and tell their stories?
I think you have to be, it's okay to make mistakes, and tell yourself that it's okay to make mistakes. I think that is the most important thing to remember. And I wish that I had taken that to heart when I was a child.
Mara, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mara Wilson. She's best known for her roles as the little girl from Mrs. Doubtfire, Matilda, and Miracle on 34th Street. Her most recent book is called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about rising household incomes in the United States and how some Wisconsin municipalities are still lagging behind the nation. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, local and state officials said yesterday, and they called for the removal of thousands of lead water pipes across the state to address high levels of lead contamination found among children in Milwaukee and elsewhere. We'll talk with an investigative reporter about the plan and what it could cost.
First, for most of us, the word school might bring to mind a teacher, blackboard, rows of students at their desks. In other words, your typical classroom.
A new generation of educators and entrepreneurs are trying to come up with innovative ways to teach and to learn. The work of several of these Education Innovators is highlighted on a new television series called TED Talks, Education Revolution. It premieres Tuesday on PBS as part of its Spotlight Education Week.
Educator and social entrepreneur Sal Khan is featured in that series. He's an educator and social entrepreneur, founder and CEO of Khan Academy, a nonprofit free online education platform offering software, tutorials, and video lessons on academic subjects from kindergarten through college. He joins us now. Sal, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, can you tell us about the humble origins of this, what's now a big name, the Khan Academy?
Yeah, it was in 2004. My day job, I was an analyst at an investment firm. My original background was in technology, and my 12-year-old cousin, she was 12 at the time, was having trouble with math. I offered to tutor her just over the phone, and we used Instant Messenger because she was in New Orleans. I was in Boston at the time. That worked out well. Then I started working with her younger brothers. Word got around the family through tutoring was going on. I soon found myself working with 10, 15 cousins, family, friends all over the country. And I started writing some software for them so that they could get practice, really fill in their gaps. And a friend suggested that I make videos to supplement that software. And those videos kind of took on a life of their own. My cousins famously said they liked me better on YouTube than in person. It soon became clear who people who weren't my cousins started watching. And one thing led to another. I set it up as a not-for-profit in 2008, and today, as you mentioned, Khan Academy, we have over 42 million registered users. It's all free. We're not-for-profit. It's videos. It's exercises where you've been used inside and outside of classroom. We're translating to the major languages of the world.
Before we talk about innovation more generally, let's look at what you're doing at the Khan Academy a little more. The idea here isn't we're replacing all schooling with these videos, right? This is a supplement that teachers, students, homeschoolers, whoever could use, right?
Well, it could be a supplement or it could be a primary resource. But even as a primary resource, we never imagined that it was somehow a virtual tool should replace a physical classroom. It's not like a Amazon.com versus Barnes & Noble thing. What we imagine is if students can get on-demand explanations from their phone or from a computer, if they can get practice problems, especially ones that give them immediate feedback that adapt to their needs, that it really frees up the class for more human interaction, where a teacher can better differentiate instruction. They can take some students aside and do a more focused intervention. They can see that, okay, all my students have learned this concept. Now I can do a project on it or maybe a Socratic dialogue on it. So we view it as if you're a part of the world where you don't have access to a school, say you're in a village in rural India, well, if you have access to a low-cost smartphone, you should be able to self-educate yourself through Khan Academy. But if you're in Wisconsin and you do have access to a school, that we can supercharge what happens in that school so that it empowers the teachers and the students. And, of course, can be used by students on their own if they're having trouble understanding what their textbook is saying or reviewing something that was covered in class. Khan Academy can be a great place for them.
As we mentioned, you're featured in an upcoming PBS series on innovation in education. Do you think that there's a lot more room, that we're just sort of scratching the surface of available technology that could revolutionize the way we teach?
Oh, yeah. I think we're just at the very beginning right now. We've had the last education revolution was about 200 years ago when we had the introduction of mass public education, which was a major education revolution. It really should be listed up there with, the printing press and the invention of writing in terms of transforming humanity. 300-400 years ago, it was not, literacy rates were in the 20% or so range globally, even in wealthier parts of the world. And now in middle-income countries, they're approaching 100% literacy, and hopefully we get that for the rest of the world. What's interesting now is we have a chance with technology of revisiting some assumptions that we first made 200 years ago when we first did mass public education. In order to be able to reach everyone, we put 30 students together in a classroom. We move them all together at a set pace. The best that the instructor can do is kind of a one-pace-fits-all, give a lecture. It might be too slow for some students. It might leave some students behind, but there's not much you can do. But now with technology, we actually can start to differentiate for all the students, let the content be more personalized, and free up the teacher and free up the students for more interaction with each other.
I wonder, how do we measure the impact of new innovations so that we know we're not just, throwing innovations in for innovation's sake, that we're actually getting some bang for our buck?
Well, I think the first important thing about some of the new innovations we're talking about is that we can actually measure them for the first time. Today, if we think about the current primary resource in classrooms, the textbook, no one has any idea on whether people are using it, how much they're using it. The textbook publisher doesn't know which pages are effective, which ones aren't. When they publish version 2 versus version 1, they have no idea whether it's actually better. Teachers don't know which items are being used and how. And so when you start moving to some of these digital platforms at a very baseline, you can even start saying, okay, well, that's being used in this way. The content creators can say, okay, let me try the second version and see if it leads to more engagement or whether the students are more likely to answer the questions right. You can immediately give more feedback and data to students as well. But we've also started doing efficacy studies in classrooms. We did a pretty deep one in Idaho where we saw that time spent on a platform like Khan Academy led to much more than expected gains for students, more than you would even expect. You'd expect a strong student to get even stronger, et cetera, but on average, we saw about 1.8 times the learning in a year that you would expect to see. Khan Academy right now, we're the official prep for the SAT, and we're working very closely with the College Board on understanding what typical gains are from, say, the PSAT in 10th grade to the SAT in 12th grade, and what the gains are when the students are using the personalized learning platform.
Talking to Sal Khan of the Khan Academy. He's the founder and CEO there. Talking about innovation in education, he and others will be featured on a PBS series kicking off next Tuesday called TED Talks Education Revolution. Sal, we have a problem in Wisconsin, pretty widely acknowledged, educational attainment, achievement gaps, especially between white and black students, wealthier and poorer students. How do we make sure that new innovations don't just help the people who are already doing pretty well do even better, and that they reach the people who need them the most?
Yeah, this is a central question for us. And, we see it as two issues. There's kind of an awareness issue, and then there's an accessibility issue. The accessibility issue is maybe the harder one, where, the 30% of families in the U.S. who don't have access to broadband are disproportionately in lower income and underrepresented minority communities. So we can't. We're as a small organization, we're not directly playing the role of how do we get access. But we talk to folks like Google and Comcast and the FCC, and we say, look, this is a major reason why you need to get more access for more students. The good thing is things like cell phone penetration is quite high. And broadband through things like cell phones. And so that's why we're trying to make a lot of our work accessible through things like mobile devices. On things like the SAT, this is a big priority for both us and College Board. So we partnered with a lot of after-school programs, Boys and Girls Club, to make sure that there's access. A lot of it is just awareness. Folks who might listen to National Public Radio or 60 Minutes or pay attention to things in the tech sector might know about things like Khan Academy, but a lot more folks don't. So how do we get awareness that this is all free? It's not for profit. It's all non-commercial. It's free tutoring for your child. It's a free textbook for your classroom. How do we get the word out there? And I don't want to pretend that by itself is going to fix the problem. A lot of what you just talked about are problems beyond the scope of, just Khan Academy or just the education sector. There are issues of, broader issues of poverty and inequity.
What kind of things do you hear from teachers who have maybe had experience using material from the Khan Academy?
Yeah, we have over a million teachers using us in different ways. Some of them will just write our web address, khanacademy.org, on the chalkboard at the beginning of the school year and say, hey, if you ever get stuck or need any help, this is a pretty good resource for you. While at the other end of the spectrum, some teachers are using us as a primary resource where the students are going through the material, doing the exercise. The teachers are getting a daily feedback on where the students are, and they're using that data to, instead of kind of a one pace for everyone, say, okay, those students are progressing, let them continue to progress. These students are having a little bit of trouble on negative numbers, let me do a very focused intervention with them. Or all of my class is now ready for ratio, so I can do a class project with them. And so they've moved their classroom to this more, I would say, kind of interactive, personalized model.
I want to bring on a caller. We've got Tom on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to speak with the founder of the Khan Academy. I work for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, and I wanted you to just be aware we are going to be testing a device shortly that's called Rachel, the Remote Area Community Hotspots for Education and Learning, which provides an offline learning environment. And the Khan Academy Lite is included in that content. And from what we've seen so far, we believe this is really going to ramp up and transform our education offerings and lead to great benefits for those who are incarcerated who sorely need greater educational achievement.
Tom, I want to jump in and give Sal a chance to respond as we're almost out of time, not just in the schools, but now in Wisconsin, anyway, in our correctional facilities.
Yeah, I mean, we're also really intrigued by this possibility. There's been experiments like this in other states as well. And we're actually hoping that, in prisons, they don't allow internet connection, so there's not communication with the outside. But if we can make versions of Khan Academy, there's a version called KA Lite, but if we can even do ones that are connected to the outside but avoid kind of non-academic communication, I think this is a huge possibility where people could, use that time while they're in prison really productively, possibly get, high school equivalency or college credit, and most importantly, just learn a lot. This is something that could be very exciting. We're also seeing similar things in, kids who are in hospitalized for long periods of time, can't go to traditional school, child athletes, but the prisons in particular are something that's close to our heart.
Sal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's educator and social entrepreneur Sal Khan, founder of the Khan Academy, a nonprofit free online education platform. He's one of the featured speakers on the TED Talks Education Revolution series, which premieres Tuesday night on Wisconsin Public Television as part of the PBS Spotlight Education Week. Check local listings for airtimes.
Coming up, state and local officials say they hope to remove more than 100,000 lead water pipes across the state to address the danger of lead contamination in children. An investigative reporter provides details. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we hear about Senator Ron Johnson's Right to Try bill, which would give terminally ill patients more access to experimental drugs that haven't gotten FDA approval.
First, from the arrival of early European settlers to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, conflicts over Native American lands have been a big part of American history. Last month, we talked to Naomi Schaefer Riley, author of the book The New Trail of Tears. She argued that reservations see high rates of poverty and suicide because of current federal policy on land ownership. The main problem with that policy, she argued, was that it didn't allow for private land ownership.
We heard from callers and listeners after that in Wisconsin, including some of the state's own Native American communities, who felt that the conversation needed another perspective. Our next guest recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Private Land Ownership Won't Solve Native American Poverty. That article's posted on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Kelly Mosteller. She's director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center and a tribal historic preservation officer based in Oklahoma. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And you say there's kind of a fundamental difference in some ways between the ways a lot of American culture thinks of land and the way Native American communities often do. You say in your article that for most Americans, land is money. How does that run counter to how a lot of tribal cultures view land?
Well, I think that the argument there is that it's not a simple link between land ownership equaling success and money. And I'm also not trying to argue that for Native Americans that we don't understand the importance of land for financial and economic gain. But in our case, we do have historic either ancestral ties to this land, or it is the source of our land base that allows us to have sovereignty and authority and dictate how our communities are managed and run. So, for Native Americans, the land is not just, that piece of property which we can buy and sell and exploit for financial gain. It has that cultural element, and it is the literal foundation of our tribal sovereignty and of our nations.
I want to listen to a little bit of our previous guest, Naomi Schaefer Riley, talking some about federal land policies and reservations.
Okay. Now, actually, the policies are preventing Native Americans from exercising economic freedom. And what I mean by that is that Native Americans don't actually own reservation land. The fact that it's held in trust by the federal government means that they can't buy it and sell it among themselves without the approval of a staff member at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. It means that if an American Indian wanted to go to the bank and get a mortgage to purchase a house, he could not do that because the bank would say, you don't have the underlying title to the land.
So what's your reaction to that and the rest of her argument for that matter?
Well, that statement has a lot of issues packed into it, and I feel like she glosses over that. The first thing is that there are 560-plus tribes in the United States, and each of them has their own circumstances. I know you did get around to that eventually in the previous interview, but even the statement that Native Americans don't own their land, there are a lot of different land statuses for Native Americans. Individual tribal members can own land both in trust and in fee, which is essentially own it privately with some restrictions. And then tribes can also own land in trust or in fee, or fee land without restrictions on it. So essentially like any other group would own land. So that argument has not even been made within her Atlantic article or the interview that I heard with you. She's really talking about strictly reservation land. And that's very different for a tribe that lives on a reservation than tribes like my own and all of the tribes in Oklahoma. We do not have true reservations in Oklahoma, and we have 39 tribes here. What we have is jurisdiction. Tribal lands are held in trust in a checkerboard pattern often because we purchase back lands that have been moved out of tribal hands, and we're purchasing them back as a tribe, but we own it first in fee, and then we go through the process to put it into trust so that it becomes part of our jurisdiction and our base of our authority for our tribal government. So even the argument that all land is reservation land and that it has this one distinct status, that oversimplifies the issue. Also, the current policy, as she states, is that the federal government owns the land and has the title to the land and holds it in trust for the tribes. And I don't have the exact quote, but I do believe that she mentioned something that you only hold things in trust for children or for those who are mentally incapable of caring for it for themselves. The status of trust land for Native American tribes is a little bit different than that. It's actually the trust relationship between the tribes and the federal government also means that the tribes have the guarantee of that the federal government should uphold their federal trust responsibility. So it's a two-way street. You know, it does put some restrictions on what the tribe can do with the land as far as selling it and things like that, but it also means that the federal government has an obligation to uphold the laws and the treaties and all of the pieces of legislation that protect that land from being taxed by local municipalities or encroached upon by landowners or corporations. And it provides some of the protections that Native Americans have experienced with a tax on their lands for more than two centuries.
We're talking to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center. She's based in Oklahoma, talking about Native Americans and property ownership in the United States. And Kelly, our guest Naomi Schaefer Riley had talked about difficult conditions facing some Native Americans in some communities, poverty, suicide rates, things like that. She tried to draw a direct line between the current state of property ownership and said, don't keep looking to history or historic injustice to explain these problems. You say we need to pay attention to the history of American treatment of Native Americans and land ownership in particular. Can you spell that out a little?
Absolutely. You can't look at a people whose legal rights and legal foundations are built on 200-plus years of failed policies and the legislation that results from them, and it, to disregard the decades and decades of work that tribes have put into pushing for the honoring of treaties and for distancing ourselves from any kind of incursions by the federal government or other than individuals that would bring back policies like allotment, which is essentially what Naomi Schaefer Riley is pushing for. It's just repackaged in a 21st century format for, you know, free market audience. What we're trying to say is that to say that you have to disregard the history and only look at the current policy is naive of the fact that these policies that are impacting us today are built on those foundations. It is built on 200 years of colonialism and people being moved off of their land for the sake of taking it into private hands and exploiting it for non-Native communities. It looks at our residential schools and children being taken away from their families and that impact that it has on them and the hurt and the pain and the historic trauma that has been passed down through communities that does have a direct impact on the very statistics that she was mentioning, the suicide rates, the alcohol rates, and things like that. Also, she is very much cherry-picking the communities that have some of the worst social conditions in the country. You know, I could very easily go through and if I was wanting to do the same thing for the United States at large and choose cities that have certain social conditions that are more challenging than others, but to then come behind and suggest a sweeping policy that applies to all of them would be to disregard those unique circumstances of each community have their historic base, and that's essentially what she's doing. Each have a historic base that has made these conditions present in their community.
One thing you recommend in your piece in the Atlantic that would maybe be aimed at the unique nature of all the different communities, you're looking for more sovereignty from recognized by the federal government, more autonomy from the federal government, I gather, so that communities could make their own decisions more tailored to their own situations. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Each of these communities, as I mentioned, has their own history. So any time the federal government has tried to dictate from Washington a single unified Indian policy that applies to everyone, it has been a complete disaster and has been incredibly destructive to Native communities culturally, economically, socially. All of these elements have played out for the near destruction of many tribes. The only way we are going to see social and economic advancement in Native communities is to pull back and allow those tribes to decide what is needed in their community, whether it is more health care services, whether it is housing for elders, schools, whatever it may be. The federal government has the obligation to carry out the treaties and the various compacts that they've signed with these tribes. But it doesn't mean that they should have to dictate where every single dollar goes if it doesn't make sense for that community. It must, all of the changes that are going to bring about beneficial social and economic advancement for Native American tribes are going to be rooted within the tribes themselves. Let them decide what they need for their own communities.
We're talking to Kelly Mosteller. She's director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center and a tribal historic preservation officer. She says a sweeping change, one of her previous guests had called for, to private land ownership across the board is not the best solution for economic problems facing Native American communities.
And we want to hear from you on this. Tell us where you stand on private land ownership for Native American reservations. Do you think it would help or that the benefits are overstated? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of a tribe, tell us how you view land and what it means to you and your community. And tell us what you think the federal government's role on reservations should be. Again, that number, 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up the conversation with Kelly Mosteller. She says private land ownership is not the solution to poverty in Native American communities. We heard the argument for private land ownership on reservations in particular last month from Naomi Schaefer Riley, author of the book The New Trail of Tears.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of a tribe, we want to hear how you feel. In particular, tell us what you think the federal government's role should be on reservations, especially as controversy around the Dakota Access Pipeline continues. Our number is 800-642-1234.
And Kelly, I want to go back to that previous interview we mentioned, the guest making the case that modern issues of stereotyping not a big part of the problem. I'm going to give a little listen here to her talking about the Native American mascot issue.
I went to a variety of Indian communities across the country, and I was hard-pressed to find somebody who thought about changing team names or mascots as a priority in addressing the needs of their community. And as you can see from a recent Washington Post poll that suggested that 9 out of 10, or more than 9 out of 10, American Indians said they didn't really care about the name Redskins for the Washington football team.
So, Kelly, how do you think these issues about mascots and symbols fit into the larger conversation?
I think that symbols have power and words have power. The first issue that I have with her statement is the citing of the Washington Post poll. It is an incredibly problematic poll. It allowed for people who self-identify as Native American to comment as though they were tribal members, and that would include anyone who, you know, their family history tells that there was a Native American person somewhere in the past. You know, they could claim to be Native American. If you poll people who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes, those numbers are much stronger to show that this is an issue. And there has been a lot of work done around this in recent years, and there are studies that have been conducted that shows that it does impact young Native Americans, especially those in elementary school. It affects their self-esteem and the way they see themselves and the way their classmates see them. One of the phrases that I heard Naomi Schaefer Riley use was that it is absurd and offensive to focus energies on issues like the mascot issue when there are so many other social problems. And to use the words absurd and offensive for the efforts of a Native community that they themselves have decided this is important for their community is exactly what I was discussing earlier. It is about not understanding sovereignty. The Oneida Nation, for example, has chosen to make the mascot issue a priority for them, and they have actually launched the website changethemascot.org. Each of these communities has the right to set what is a priority for them, and so to be disparaging of that by saying it's absurd and offensive it's inappropriate. It's highly inappropriate. And I can say that as a Native American who works in a Native community with Native youth, it does affect them. A high school very close to us has the mascot of the Savages, and many of the students I've worked with attend that school, and they talk to me about how it made them feel to have that name and that mascot around them every day, and to go to pep rallies and see effigies of Native Americans being, drugged behind cars and things like that. It happens every year around football season. And I had a young student who actually, in her graduation announcement, she, at the very top of it, said, on her graduation announcement, "I'm not a savage, I'm a Muskogee." It takes away the individual identity. And as I said earlier, words have power. It really does matter. And I've heard it firsthand from students who say that it does.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just like to make a comment about that last comment. Wow, yes, mascots should be abolished. I went to high school, Mound Mohawks, and now it's the West Tonka Wildcats, and I'm very glad that they did change that. But my reason for calling was a comment about if they make all tribal lands private, then that would open up the possibility of a very wealthy land developer or oil company to come in and purchase that land, and then there would be no more reservations.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Kelly?
I completely agree. It opens up to land speculation. When land is held privately, it opens up the possibility for the claim of eminent domain. Private land ownership does not have the same protections that trust land has. Also, the tribes do not have the authority to speak as a sovereign nation on privately held land. So, for example, with the Dakota Access Pipeline, I've heard some arguments made that, well, if the tribe had owned that land privately, they could have stopped the pipeline. And I think that's a naive description of the situation. There are a lot of ways that private lands are taken from private citizens every day, but it is much more difficult if the tribe has trust status on that land. They are seen as the sovereign governing body over that land, and their tribal historic preservation officer, of which I am for my tribe, has a lot more authority on the projects that take place on that land.
Aaron, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center, talking about land ownership, Native Americans, and federal law and federal treaties. We'll go next to Lucille in Luxembourg from Oklahoma, I understand. Lucille, hi.
Hi. I don't think they should let the land go to private owners. It's my opinion. I think that the Indians should have their own land, and they should take care of it, and the private people should stay away from it. But I also want to know is my husband's mother put on her birth certificate she was white. How does he go around? How does he go about finding out his heritage?
So wait, do you think she was actually Native American, Lucille?
Yes, he's Cherokee. He's part Cherokee.
All right, Lucille.
His grandmother was a medicine woman in the tribe.
Lucille, thanks for that call. I don't know if you want to address that briefly, Kelly, if there's a way to track tribal heritage.
Actually, if she does have an inclination as to what tribe he would have been a member of, you can reach out to that tribe's tribal enrollment department, and each tribe has their own qualifications for how to get on their rolls. So that is dictated by each sovereign tribe.
All right. Lucille, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Matthew in Baraboo. Matthew, hi.
Hi. I'm actually taking cultural diversity class right now. We are actually covering this very subject right now. And we're in the subject right now where they had actually abolished the private land ownership from the Native American. And I was just wondering, why would we be bringing it up subject of trying to make it private once again? We originally disregarded all our responsibilities federally and allowed the tribes to take over their own lands on reservation land.
Matthew, bad signal there, but I think we get the gist. And Kelly, you've written and said that you're kind of surprised that we're bringing back kind of a 19th century idea that you say has already failed.
Absolutely. This is essentially the same principle as allotment, which was a policy that was implemented in the late 19th century. Different tribes had to undergo the allotment process at different times, but it essentially took commonly held land and surveyed it out and broke it into different parcels, and each tribal member was to select a parcel and eventually get the title to that land and to become private landowners, with the end result in claiming to be that they would become assimilated farmers and prosper. What happened almost every single case is that the land was taxed, or that there would be a crop failure and someone wouldn't be able to pay taxes, or that, as the first caller mentioned, land speculators would come through and undercut an individual or outright steal land that wasn't being occupied at that time and just be a squatter, and all of a sudden there's all kinds of legal questions about who owns the land. So we have seen this policy implemented before under another name.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center. She's a tribal historic preservation officer. We've been talking about Native Americans, land ownership, and federal law. Last month we talked to a guest who said we need more private land ownership. Kelly made the case against it today.